evaded capture for months now, and has even escaped, miraculously, from him. You need to know that this is an issue. It's very possible that he had something to do with Sai's death. The chief just stares at me. Then he gets to his feet and rakes his fingers through his hair. I note the confusion in his eyes, as if he doesn't know which way to turn. I just need to push harder. Call Dylan Roberts off. Let me go.
But I've already let Memphis know he's the one coming.
Call them back. You gotta let me do this, Chief. He looks even older now than he did moments ago.
She claims you're the killer. She says she has evidence against you. She has this whole story about your part in all these murders.
What? I say, acting shocked. Come on! They gotta be laughing that off. It's ludicrous. We're not going to let a known killer call the shots, are we?
He slides his hands into his trouser pockets, and I can tell I've really confused him. So I double down.
Chief, she's a con artist and a killer, and Dylan may be involved in Sai's death. I have reason to believe that he's been helping her all this time, that he let her walk away in Shady Grove. We're wasting time here, Chief. You gotta let me go. I have a buddy with a plane, and I can get him to fly me over. I can have her back here tonight. Then we can sort all this out.
He finally lets out a hard sigh.
All right, Gordon, he says. I'll make some phone calls. I'll call Roberts off.
Tell the Memphis PD I'm not really the boogeyman.
He gives me a weak smile. Don't worry, Chief. Once all her crimes come out, nobody's going to believe she's innocent.
I grab my jacket, shrug it on as Gates leaves the room. As I walk out, someone says, "Where are you going?"
I turn back with a Cheshire Cat grin.
"I'm going to get me a cute little homicidal maniac," I say, and I march out and down the stairs.
25. Keegan.
I cut corners on my pre-flight checklist, something a pilot is never supposed to do. But I've got to get my plane to Memphis to pick up Cox before Dylan gets there. Takeoff takes too long, but I have to wait for the air traffic controller to give me clearance to take the runway. When I'm finally airborne, I try to decide what I'll do once I get her. I have no intention of bringing her back, on my plane or otherwise. I'll rent a car when I get there, take her from the Memphis jail as if I'm transporting her back, and then do what I have to do to silence her. She can't ever make it back to Shreveport to tell her story in person. The details of my plan hang me up. Will her death fulfill the prophecies she's made to the Memphis PD? There are ways around that. I'll make it look like I had to shoot her during an escape attempt. I just have to make sure there are no witnesses and no evidence. Drew Peterson stayed out of prison for years until he made some mistakes. I won't make mistakes. If somehow the media gets wind of her statement in Memphis and starts digging like a dog with a bone, I can stall. Like getting a lawyer who can make sure they don't interview me. I don't want it to go that far. If it does, people will doubt me, and my life will go south. This line of thinking makes me wonder if I've handled everything right. I go back over the ways I hid the evidence after killing Rollins. I couldn't have missed anything, could I? What if they detect my DNA? My shaved head minimizes the possibility of a hair being left behind, but there's always the hair on my arms, or sweat, or oil from my skin. I covered all my footprints, but I could have missed something because it was dark. What if there's a fiber from what I was wearing? I should have burned everything I was wearing that night. Panic rises in me, but I quash it. No, I've come this far out of sheer intellect and caution, and I can keep going. The lights below me fade into the darkness of acres and acres of woods and crops, and I hit the Mississippi River and go north, following its path, traveling low. I work through my answers to the things Cox has already told them. The things about her dad should be easy enough. I can make the case that it was a 12-year-old girl who was emotionally traumatized and trying to find anyone but her father to blame for his death. I'll keep talking up the mother's mental illness and how it must have been passed on to the daughter. But what else does she know? What if she suggested to the Memphis cops that I'm Cy's killer? She can't know since she wasn't there. So I'll tell them I was with J.J. Parker that night, watching the taped USC championship game, and that he and I were awake until well past 4 a.m., at which point he sacked out on my couch and I went to bed. He owes me, J.J. does. I know where his bodies are buried, too, since I hired him to bury them, and I know where he spent his cash. Gail will know it's a lie, but my wife knows not to cross me. But what if it's not enough? The thought plagues me. What if I kill her and then discover that I've forgotten something? I play with the thought of keeping Cox alive and actually bringing her back, of putting her in my plane, handcuffed and shackled. Then I fantasize about opening the plane's door and shoving her out. No, that would never work, because her body would be found. That's the key, I think. Her body can never be found. Yes, people have to think she's still hiding. Maybe I could even set up another Casey Cox homicide, with her possessions, hair, and DNA at the scene. Adding to her kill list would distract everyone from me. I've been flying mostly over forest, but now I see a cleared space, no trees, a long, long way from any houses, and then it dawns on me. I need to find a place like that. A cleared place where I can kill her and then start a bonfire to burn her body without risking starting a forest fire, which would draw all the wrong kinds of attention. Then I can claim she escaped and that she's still out there somewhere. As long as they never find the body, I'll be okay. I can't help laughing out loud. The thing I've got going for me is that once she's out of the way, even though she spun her story to the Memphis PD, everyone will want to believe me instead of her. And then when I get back, I'll find Dylan Roberts and finish him off too. The turncoat is not going to turn on me.
26. Dylan. My flight is delayed for 45 minutes, and each second that ticks by is like a sledgehammer through my temple. Keegan will be on his way to Memphis soon, with or without Gates's blessing. I watch out the window for a Cessna taking off, but I haven't seen one. When we're finally on our way, the smell of alcohol drifts through the plush plane as the three record executives being transported to Nashville celebrate some deal they just signed with a recording artist who lives in the area. They live large, which is why they have a King Air to fly them. Since it's a jet, I pray it'll get there faster than Keegan's Cessna. I close my eyes, feigning sleep, and cover Casey in prayer. I try to believe that God is on top of this, that he will protect Casey from Keegan, that he hasn't brought us this far just to turn his back on us now. But God's ways have never been my ways. Brent is dead. Keegan is still walking free, and Casey is sitting in jail. If only I had a minute of FaceTime with God to get clear marching orders. Before we make our final descent into Memphis, I call the fixed base operator there and ask if my rental car has been delivered. The man at the desk tells me Hertz has just delivered two.
What do you mean, two?
I ask him.
One for you and one for another guy from Shreveport who just landed in a Cessna.
I close my eyes. I can't believe this. Somehow Keegan beat me here. My mind races. I'm still the one sent to bring Casey back, and the Memphis police know that. They're not likely to turn Casey over to Keegan. Then again, he's slyer than a fox, and he's persuasive.
What are the two cars? I ask. Want to make sure you get the best one?
The guy asks with a chuckle.
Looks like there's a silver Enclave and a black Tahoe. Your name's on the Enclave.
So Keegan's getting a black Tahoe.
Okay, that's fine.
I say.
Just do me a favor, would you? Don't mention to the other guy that I'm coming in. He's my colleague, and we've got a competition going on. I'm trying to win. Will do, he says cheerily.
I click off my phone and think. Maybe I could flatten a tire on the Tahoe if it's still there when I get to the office. That would slow him down. But I would have to get there before he claims his car, and the plane is taking its migraine-inducing time to get to the tarmac. I've broken out in a sweat by the time we slow and turn toward the buildings. I search through the window for the two rental cars parked side by side in a parking lot beside the building, where Keegan may be by now. I look for the plane I've seen Keegan in before, but the airport is too big. I can't see it. The King Air taxis to the gate where I'm getting off, and as we approach, I see Keegan's plane. He's already tied it down. I thank the pilots and wait until the door is open, and then I jog down the steps. I'm headed across the tarmac to the FBO when I see the black Tahoe pulling away. I want to punch something. I hurry into the office, but the guy at the desk has gone to the bathroom. I wait, pacing in front of it, but he takes his sweet time. When he comes back, he's full of chatter. Keegan must have paid him off to slow me down. I encourage him to do my transaction as quickly as possible, and a few minutes later I'm in my enclave, typing the police department's address into the car's GPS. I study an overhead view and figure out the shortest route. While it's loading, I glance at my voicemail. Chief Gates has left a message. I click on it and hear his voice.
Dylan, I'm sorry about this, but I've decided to let Keegan go get Cox. I thought he'd be tied up with the funeral plans, but he insisted that he's on this. Just stand down and come on back. We'll reimburse you for any expenses you've incurred. Sorry, let me know when you're back in town.
I let out a yell, knowing no one can hear. How did Keegan pull this off, considering all the questions surrounding him now? I try to think. Maybe there's enough confusion about the extradition that I could convince them I'm still the one supposed to get her. Keegan will probably get there first, but there'll be paperwork. They have to get an extradition warrant, and that takes time. As I'm driving, I call the Memphis PD, ask to speak to the detective on Casey Cox's case. A guy named Leibowitz picks up, and I burst into my pitch.
Hi, my name is Dylan Roberts. I'm working with the Shreveport Police Department on the Casey Cox case, and I'm on my way there right now to transport her. I wondered if you could start processing her extradition paperwork. I'd like to get her back to Shreveport as soon as possible.
I don't know about that, the detective says. We were told you were coming, but then we got different orders. We're supposed to turn her over to Detective Keegan now.
No, I say quickly. That would be a terrible mistake. She'll use that in court, that she implicated him in several murders and you still turned her over to him. It'll be a publicity nightmare for you guys.
There's a moment of silence on the other end of the phone.
I was a little concerned about that, too, but our captain wants us to comply with what the Shreveport PD has requested. Keegan is in town. He's on his way here. So am I.
I grasp at straws, trying to think of a persuasive argument.
Look, this could put him in a bad situation and compromise the investigation. Imagine the narrative if the press gets wind of her accusations and learns you put her in his hands. It has the appearance of impropriety.
He doesn't immediately respond, so I hope he's processing that.
I'll call Chief Gates. There's no hurry here. Just don't let him have her yet.
He hesitates again, so I try one last shot.
Look, man, I'm an Afghanistan and Iraq veteran, and I just got hired by the Shreveport PD. If I don't bring her back, then I probably don't have a shot at keeping this job.
My son is serving right now.
I seize on that.
Then you know what it's like. You want him to get a job when he gets back, right? I was in the CID in the Army. It's like being an FBI special agent. And I just got hired on with the Shreveport PD. I have to do this. And if Gordon Keegan has been accused of anything, even by someone who's taking her last desperate shot, then it doesn't help anyone if he's the one bringing her back. I'm sure he'd agree with that if he knew the whole story. Just hold on until I can get there and get Chief Gates on the phone with you.
I don't have the authority to make this decision,
Leibowitz says.
I'll have to talk to my captain.
We're still waiting for the extradition warrant, so it'll take a while anyway.
He hangs up on me. I check my GPS and try to figure out how much farther I've got. Only 5 more miles. I wipe the sweat off my lip and my temples and call Chief Gates, praying he's still in his office. His secretary puts me right through.
Dylan?
He asks when he picks up.
Chief, I'm in Memphis. Listen, you've got to let me get her. I'm almost there. I came all the way here. Jim Pace wants me to bring her back, and with the accusations made against Keegan,
I'm letting him do it, Dylan. It's a matter of honor with him.
But it compromises everything.
I go into the same spiel I gave the Memphis detective.
Look, Chief, there'll come a time when she talks to the media, and if she tells them you turned her over to the person she claims committed all these murders, they're not going to give the benefit of the doubt to the cop. They're going to milk the story for all it's worth, focusing on the pretty girl who couldn't have done such a brutal thing, and it might damage the investigation.
His voice is higher pitched than usual.
On the other hand, if you take her and she somehow escapes, the narrative will be that I put her in the hands of a brand new hire.
But that's always been my task. I've always planned to bring her back when I found her.
Well, you didn't find her. Dylan, I've thought it over. I'm just going to let Keegan bring her back. Your job is over here. Come on back.
He clicks off the phone, ending the call, and I throw it, bouncing it off my seat.
No, I can't let this stand. I have to somehow convince them. I have to protect Casey. I will not let Keegan kill her.
27. Casey. My toes are turning blue, but this holding cell could be a lot worse. I don't mind the cold so much. I have a thin blanket I can put around my shoulders. It's not long enough to cover my whole body, I guess because they're afraid I'll make a noose and hang myself somehow. I'm thankful for my socks. One of the trustees who brought my food told me that when I'm taken upstairs to the general population, they'll issue me some socks, and they don't fit well and aren't as good as mine. She let me keep my own for now. I'm hungry, but even that isn't as bad as it could be because they gave me a ham sandwich earlier. That settled my stomach somewhat. I have to say that unburdening my soul and confessing everything to the police, both good and bad, has made me feel much lighter. It's only the dread of Keegan getting his hands on me that keeps me unsettled. But God has been with me so far, and I think I saw a flicker of belief on the detectives' faces when I told them about Keegan. At least there's doubt there, which I hope will make them look into things. I know that if Dylan knows I'm in custody, he's probably sent our evidence to some media person, or he's already taken it to the DA. And I beg God to let Dylan miraculously be the one who's sent to transport me. That would be a miracle. I sit on the bench with my back against the painted cinder block wall, and I doze for a moment. Then, suddenly, there's a clang, making me jump, and the door swings open.
Cox! You're being extradited to the Shreveport police.
I get to my feet, confused. I'm instantly alert as I walk out in my sock feet, looking around me, anxious to see who's waiting. Please let it be Dylan. Please let it be Dylan. As we round the corner to the hallway, I hear a voice that makes my blood chill. Gordon Keegan. Cackling like he's a good old boy and the other detectives are his fishing buds. They're talking about fantasy football and placing bets. He's a master. I look for an exit, but of course there is no way out. As the guard leads me to that room, I stop. She grabs my arm and her hand moves to her taser.
Come on! Move!
I step into the room and see him. The hair on the back of my neck rises. Tears sting my eyes. I can't look at him. I feel suddenly hot, my ears burning, my hands beginning to sweat. I can hardly swallow, my mouth is so dry. The two detectives have clearly already forgotten what I've told them.
Well, if it isn't the disappearing Casey Cox, Keegan says.
He glances toward one of the guards.
Go ahead and get her personal effects. I'm ready to get her on the road.
I want a lawyer, I blurt. Before I leave, I need to see my lawyer.
Keegan looks up. Is that alarm in his eyes?
You can get a lawyer when we get to Shreveport.
I look at him full on now, my gaze sharp.
My lawyer lives here.
Detective Breyer, who seemed to half believe my story, scratches his head.
Who's your lawyer?
Billy Barbero, I say.
Suddenly, fear overtakes me. What am I thinking? I'm going to hire an ambulance chaser to represent me on a murder charge when he doesn't even know who I am? But I can't change course now.
I need to talk to him before they take me. Please call him.
So let me get this straight, Keegan says. You've been interviewing her for hours, and she lawyers up now, before you extradite her? No way. That's not gonna happen. She can get a lawyer in Shreveport. I don't have to say a word to her on the way. I won't ask her a thing. She can keep her lips sealed and just wait until we get back to say anything. But by God, I am going to take her back.
I turn my pleading gaze to the detectives. They're probably running the laws through their heads and considering whether they'll get blamed if I get off because they violated the rules. No cop wants to be the reason a murder charge is dropped, especially one of this magnitude. I double down on that.
I could get off on a technicality if you don't let me see my lawyer. He will tell them in court that I was not allowed an attorney when I asked for one.
Keegan speaks up quickly.
Once you ask for an attorney, we're not allowed to question you further. That doesn't mean we can't take you. In fact, I'm going to Mirandize you right now for the murder of Brent Pace in Shreveport, Louisiana. You have the right to remain silent.
I listen to my rights with my breath held, but my eyes are locked on the doubting Detective Breyer. If I can just get him to call Billy Barbero, maybe it will slow things down. Billy doesn't know Casey Cox from Adam, but he won't be able to avoid the pull into the limelight if he's chosen to represent a supposed murderer like me. It may not occur to him that I'm Leanna Winters, but he'll figure it out soon enough. My hope is dashed when Breyer looks at Keegan and says,
It's your case, man. If you want to take the risk, you can make her wait until she gets to Shreveport. Her lawyer can drive there.
I close my eyes. When I open them again, Keegan's got his crow's feet activated. He's thrilled that he's getting away with this. Where is Dylan?
I don't have time for subtlety, so I try again. If he kills me on the way back to Shreveport, you will know that I told you the truth. If I vanish or if I don't make it back, please look into what I told you. There are people who know the truth and have the evidence, and they will hold you accountable.
Keegan cackles like he just delivered a hysterical punchline.
This girl's good. You gotta hand it to her, boys. She doesn't let up. Come on. Get her back into her clothes. Give me her personal effects and we'll be on our way.
The female guard takes me into another room and watches as I change back into my clothes. I feel like I'm going to throw up, but somehow I hold it back. Instead, I whisper aloud,
God, it's in your hands now.
The guard looks disinterested as she walks me back to the detectives and hands me over to the man who will murder me. 28. Dylan. There's not a parking space open at the jail, so I double park behind the correctional facility's transport van and run inside. The guard who's supposed to be manning the front has stepped out for a moment, so I stand at the window, pacing in the tiny area next to the steel door into the jail. He doesn't come back out. After a moment, I bend down to the round hole in the glass positioned nowhere near the height of any adult human.
Hello?
I say loudly.
Anybody here?
Nothing, so I look up at the camera aimed down at me and hold out my hands as if to say, Could someone actually do their job here? I bend down and yell again. Finally, the guard returns, looking irritated.
Help you? Yeah, I'm here from Shreveport to take custody of Casey Cox. Detective Leibowitz is waiting for me.
He slides a clipboard to me in a drawer under the window.
Sign in there.
I hurriedly scribble out my info. The loud metal door slides open, and I hurry through the Sallyport where they get new arrestees out of the transport van. At the next locked door, I look up at the camera again, then back to the front desk just beyond the windows. I hear a loud click as the lock disengages. I go in and sign some more forms, then they direct me to the booking room. The guard there seems to be logging a new booking's personal items.
Excuse me, I say. I need to see Detective Leibowitz. I'm here to take custody of Casey Cox.
They're in a meeting right now, she says. You can sit down and I'll tell them you're here.
I can't accept that.
The meeting. It's about her, isn't it? She's about to be extradited, but I need to get back there. Please, go tell them I'm here.
She seems to move slower just because I asked her to hurry. It's a power thing. She takes her time finishing what she's doing, then shuffles slower than natural around the hall and down to the corner. How long since I landed? 15 or 20 minutes? I check my watch. Keegan couldn't have gotten here much faster than me, but I did see his car in the parking lot, so I know he's still here. I pace in the holding area, my head splitting. Finally, she comes back. They'll be right with you.
They'll be right with me?
I repeat.
What is this, a bank? I came to transport an inmate, and I need to see them now.
She doesn't like my tone. I told you they'll come when they can. They're busy.
I'm busy, too. Let me just go back. It's really important that I have a seat,
she yells as if I'm one of her prisoners. I huff out a sigh and glance toward the bright orange plastic seats against the wall. I step toward them, then change my mind. She can just get over it. I lunge toward the doorway she came through. She jumps out of her seat and comes after me, moving remarkably faster now.
What are you doing?
She yells. I don't look back at her or slow my step, but I'm not sure where I should go.
I'm going to get my prisoner. You get back in there!
She shrieks. I don't listen to her. I just keep walking, looking for any room that has people in it, hoping they'll hear our voices and come out into the hall. Finally, I see a plainclothes man at the end of the hallway near an exit door. I hurry toward him.
Detective, I'm Dylan Roberts. I spoke to you over the phone.
I honestly don't know if I spoke to him or someone else, but it does make him stop. He looks a little sheepish and slides his hands into his pockets, but he steps toward me.
He shot past me and came back here without permission,
the guard yells, her voice reverberating down the hall.
It's okay,
the detective says, holding out a hand to stem her assault on me.
I'll take it from here. I need to take custody of my prisoner.
I bite out.
Is she still here? I'm sorry, they just left.
I fight the urge to slam my hand against the wall.
You let Keegan take her? Are you insane? I had to,
he says.
Our captain talked to your chief and that was the plan. You don't know what you're doing.
I say,
this is going to backfire on you. If anything goes wrong with this extradition, you're going to be blamed. For handing her over to the cop who was sent to get her?
I want to scream that she's telling the truth, that Keegan wants her dead, that she'll never make it to Shreveport. But I don't have time to tell him how I know that. I push past him to the exit door he's standing beside.
Did he go out this door? They're already gone. They just drove off.
I pause for a minute, trying to control my raging need to break something.
She asked for a local lawyer before he took her, but he opted to take her on to Shreveport.
I'm sick at the thought of Casey in the car with Keegan.
She asked for a lawyer, and you didn't let her have one?
He bristles.
It was his call. He said he would call the lawyer when they got there.
I try to shift my thoughts.
She named a lawyer? She said his name is Billy Barbero. I've never heard of him.
I make a mental note of his name. I'll get in touch with him as soon as I can, and maybe he can do something to stop the extradition. Maybe he can get in touch with Gates, and the chief can call Keegan and change the plan.
So why don't you let me out the exit door? That's only for transporting inmates. You'll have to go out the way you came in.
I'm wasting time here, so I head back the way I came, past the guard who's seething over my audacity.
Thanks for your help,
I quip as I pass her. I get to the metal doors. They take as long to open as they did on the way in. And finally, I'm back in the parking garage at my car. I look to see if Keegan's SUV is still there. Of course, it's gone. I can't believe this. When in history have the wheels of justice moved this fast? I get in my car and try to figure out what Keegan will do. Will he head back toward Shreveport in the rental car? Go back to the airport and put her in his plane? Then I realize that he won't do either because he doesn't intend to transport her to Shreveport. She'll miraculously vanish, and he will skate. I'm a failure, but I try anyway, pulling out of the parking lot and heading right and trying to catch up to any car that looks like his rental. But this is useless. I have failed Casey, and it might cost her her life. When I don't find Keegan's Tahoe, I decide on another course. I pull over and Google Billy Barbero Memphis Attorney. An address and phone number come up, and I click on the number to place the call, hoping he'll answer even though it's night.
Yellow.
I'm surprised to hear that greeting.
Is this Mr. Barbero?
Yeah, that's me. Who is this?
My name is Dylan Roberts.
I know I'm speaking too fast, so I try to slow down.
I understand you're the attorney for Casey Cox.
There's a long pause.
For who? Casey Cox. She's been all over the news. You're Billy Barbero the attorney, aren't you?
Yeah, he says.
And I know who she is, but I never met the woman. You say she named me as her lawyer? That's right.
I'm confused. How would Casey have known him? Maybe he has a billboard or a commercial. Or maybe he was the first listing in the phone book.
Mr. Barbero, what kind of law do you practice? Mainly, I represent disabled people, but I consider myself a full-service attorney. If she named me, I'll be glad to defend her. Full-service?
I ask.
So you aren't a criminal attorney? Does she need a lawyer or not? Just tell me where she is.
I feel like an idiot for even talking to this man, but he's the only option I have.
I need you to listen carefully. Casey Cox has been placed in the custody of a Detective Gordon Keegan of the Shreveport PD. She claims he is the real killer of Brent Pace, among others. I need for you to call Chief Gates of the Shreveport PD and throw around as much weight as you can to stop her transport. I have evidence that Keegan is guilty and plans to kill her.
I'm listening, he says.
She doesn't have much time. Don't tell him you're not a criminal attorney. I'll call right now. Threaten to call a press conference. Threaten to smear the entire police force. Don't worry. I'm pretty good at intimidation.
He chuckles.
Casey Cox, huh?
I roll my eyes.
Move heaven and earth and call me back at this number.
When I hang up, I pull over and beg God to intervene for Casey. But I wonder if my faith is too flimsy these days to move the mountain of Gordon Keegan. 29. Casey. The very presence of Gordon Keegan makes me feel a swirl of nausea, and I can't seem to control the images of my father and Brent that keep strobing through my mind, as if my brain is cycling in and out of a dream. But it's not a dream. I'm awake, and I can smell Keegan, the sweat scent mixed with too much aftershave, and I can hear him humming some song I don't know under his breath. I lean my head back on the tan leather of his back seat, my hands bound with a plastic tie on my lap. I work them as I sit there, trying to wiggle my hands out, but he's pulled it too tight. He isn't driving toward the interstate. He has no intention of taking me to Shreveport. And he doesn't care about tainting the case that will go before the court. He doesn't intend for me to get that far. He stops humming and looks at me in his rearview mirror.
You know, darling, I don't like it when people file false reports about me. Did you think you were gonna turn the entire Memphis PD against me? Think again, sweetheart.
I told the truth, I say. That you're a bloodthirsty murderer. He laughs with giddy delight.
And nobody'll believe a word you say.
Blood on my living room wall. My screams ripping from my chest. My cries for Daddy. I close my eyes and will them to see what's in front of me now. Keegan's face is lit up under oncoming headlights. You really are a psychopath, aren't you? I ask. What happened to you? Were you abused or tortured or abandoned? He laughs again with his bone-chilling cackle.
If that's the story you want to tell yourself.
Why did you kill Rollins? I ask. Was he balking at all the murders you'd asked him to commit? Was he threatening to go to the police? Drinking too much? Of course he's not going to admit to anything, but I have to say it anyway. Dad's body swaying, his head oddly twisted in the makeshift noose, the fan creaking as though it will pull from the ceiling, the smell of death and terror, blood on the walls, on his hands, signs of a struggle. Sweat drips into my eyes now. My hair is wet and my heart is slamming. I know I'm losing it. I speak again to hear my own voice. When you killed my dad, was that quick? Or did you torture him? I know he fought back. I saw the blood. A person who hangs himself wouldn't have blood like he'd been in a fight for his life. You killed him because he was going to expose you. His smile fades and his teeth glisten against the headlights coming toward us.
I watched him strangle to death.
He looks at me in the mirror again, gauging my reaction.
Does that make you feel better?
I think of lunging forward and looping my hands over his head, cutting my plastic tie into his throat by sheer strength, my teeth sinking into his jugular. I could kill him in cold blood now, watch his life bleed away. If I have to live the rest of my life knowing I really am a killer, I'd be okay with that. I could rest knowing that he is off this earth. But then I second-guess my strength, the tightness of my wrist tie, my ability to sink a deep enough bite before he fights back. What about Brent? I ask. Did you stay until he was dead? He seems delighted that he has the chance to boast about his brilliance.
I knew he called you, he says. I knew you were coming on your lunch hour.
My brain takes me back to that moment when I turned the knob and pushed inside to call out Brent's name and found him on the floor. My brain flashes back and forth from Brent's death scene to me here in Keegan's car, then back again. I try to stay here, present. You didn't know he sent me a thumb drive, did you? Before he even called me, just in case something happened to him. I actually got it. I'm not the only one who's seen it. I see the grin fade from his eyes now, so I keep going. It was probably out in the mailbox when you murdered him, and you didn't even know it. The mailman picked it up and sent it. You dropped the ball on that one. Now I see a flicker of worry in his eyes, and he looks back at me over the seat.
Nice try. But there's no way you would have gotten any of your mail.
I smile now. Because I did get it, but I can't tell him that my landlord gave it to my sister and my sister got it to me. I just go quiet, letting him wonder. Finally, when I speak again, I say, the press is going to really enjoy getting all that the moment anything happens to me. You'll have a lot of explaining to do. He thinks that through for a moment and sees the holes in it.
They won't know whether anything happened to you. You go missing all the time. That's what's gonna happen again tonight.
He turns onto a dark dirt road into a wooded area. I want to ask him where he's taking me, but I know the answer. He's taking me to my death. If I disappear after what I told the police, they're going to know it's you. They'll dig into it and they won't let it go. He laughs again.
Not if I tell them you got away. Call a bolo. Tell them you're still on the run out there, and you're armed and dangerous. Oh, and there might be another body I set up with your possessions at the scene. I have your personal effects right here, sweetie.
It'll just add to your body count.
I meet his eyes in the mirror.
I've never been armed, I say. But I am dangerous. Even dead. The wheels are in motion to release it all to the press. You didn't think I would go without a safety net, did you?
His grin fades and he looks away. He slows at another dirt road and turns into it, lights it up with his headlights and sees a gate that's locked there. He's trying to find a place where he can murder me. At least I know he doesn't have a shovel in this rental vehicle. He probably hasn't chosen a place yet. He's figuring this out as he goes. Maybe that can play in my favor. Trying to stall, I bite my cheek until it bleeds. Then I lift my hands together and get the blood on my fingertips. I wipe some on my face so he can see it. I'm bleeding, I say. Of course he doesn't care. Yet. It's going to upset your apple cart. If there's blood evidence in this car, they'll seriously doubt your story that I escaped. He looks back at me and sees the blood I'm wiping on the seat, and I'm pretty sure his face is a whiter shade of pale. He curses and swerves. I bite my cheek again, ignoring the pain, the metallic taste spreading on my tongue. I wipe more of it on the seat and the door, then I spit it to spatter it farther. He speeds up now, muttering profanity, and I can see the homicidal intentions glistening in his eyes, but I may have bought myself a little time. He doesn't quite know what to do.
They'll know there was at least a struggle. Some of them will wonder if you killed me.
He gives up on the dirt road he's on, shifts into reverse, slams on the accelerator, and screeches back up the road again. He turns and drives back the way we came, his lights on bright, looking for another dirt road that he can turn into. That's when I know I have no choice. I have to fulfill the story he was going to tell about me anyway. I have to escape. I try the door handle, but he has the child lock on. He's probably going 40 miles an hour now as he tries to find a place to turn, but somehow I have to get out of this car. If I can get him to roll my window down, he'll have to unlatch the child lock.
I'm going to throw up, I say.
Knock yourself out.
I've never made myself throw up before, but I jab my fingers down my throat until I gag, and then jab a little harder, making myself heave. The ham sandwich comes up. He curses again, growling that I'm leaving more evidence, and he rolls my window down. The lock is now disengaged. I throw open the door and fling myself out. I hit the ground wrists first, slide painfully across the dirt, and roll down an embankment. I scramble to my feet and run faster than I knew I could until I'm in the trees, bushes scraping my skin, and then I go deeper, downhill into the woods. I stop to catch my breath, wincing at the pain in my wrists and knees, and look back to see if I can tell where he is. His car has stopped, and the interior dome light is on. He left his door open and came after me. I see the beam of his flashlight moving the wrong way, away from me. The orchestra of the forest muffles my breaths. I stay still as that beam moves in the opposite direction. I look at the car, my backseat door and his driver's door still open. My personal effects are in there on his front seat. If I could just get up there, I could get my phone. I wait until he's far enough away. Then I limp as quietly as I can back up the hill to the car, go around it and lean in on his side. I glance through the windshield. The beam is still moving in the woods. My wrist is swollen as I reach in and look for the keys, but he took them with him. The paper sack of my personal effects is sitting on his passenger seat with a label on it that has my name. I grab it, open it, and see my phone and purse. Wadding the top, I tuck the bag under my arm and cross the road and go deep into the woods on the opposite side. After several minutes of running, I look back toward the road. Through the trees, I see glimpses of light and assume he's moving back toward his car. I hear the doors close and the car begins to move, his headlights on bright. He's searching for me, desperate. I hunker down as the light passes. He goes a couple of miles up the road and makes a U-turn and comes back, looking again. I try to think like he's thinking.
He could call for backup, get the police to swarm out here looking for me, but how would he explain being so far off the path to Shreveport? How would he explain taking me to a remote place nowhere near the interstate, the blood on my seat? No, I don't think he can take that chance. He's going to have to go with his original story, even though this time, parts of it will be true. He'll have to claim it happened somewhere else along the way to where he should have been going. Yes, he's desperate, and he isn't going to give up easily. I got away from him. I'm not lying in a grave somewhere with my personal effects. I really am out here like a ticking bomb. I wait him out for at least 2 hours before he finally gives up and leaves. I know he's probably not really gone. And then I see his car coming back up the road, the headlights off this time. I cut behind a tree again, afraid he has some kind of technology I don't know about. Infrared glasses, maybe. But after another hour of searching, he finally disappears and doesn't come back. I walk up that dirt road, limping on a knee that has swollen to the size of a melon, until I see lights shining on the other side of the trees. It's a convenience store with gas pumps. I wipe the blood off my face onto my sleeve, tuck my bound hands under my shirt, and walk in fast until I get to the bathroom. When I'm locked in the ladies' room in the bright lights, I dump my personal effects out of the bag and find some nail clippers. I bend my swollen wrists until I leverage the clippers just right, and I cut the plastic tie and free myself. Then I wash the blood and vomit off my face and hands and clothes. I finger brush the leaves out of my hair. Then, gathering up all my things and putting them back into my purse, I head out. I check my cell phone for bars and a charge. Please, God. The battery is at 10%, and there's one bar out here, but it might be enough. I click on Dylan's number. He answers after the first ring, and I'm so grateful I almost can't get the words out. Dylan, it's me. 30. Dylan. When I hear her voice, I almost run off the road. My eyes sting as gratitude rushes through me. Thank you, God.
Casey, are you all right?
Yes. I can hear wind rushing into her phone. I got away. Her voice bounces as if she's walking, and she's out of breath. My phone's about to die. I'm walking down Highway 14 behind the buildings. I'm behind a furniture store that's about a half a mile down from a BP station right now. There's a sign on the gate that says Brainerd Furniture. I guess I need to call a taxi, but they'll recognize me.
I'll be there in a few minutes.
You're here? In Memphis?
Yes, I was trying to beat Keegan here. Where is he?
Looking for me? I left blood in his car. He's probably trying to clean it before he reports my escape. I turn my car around and follow its GPS.
Are you hurt? Do you need an ambulance?
No! She almost shouts. Then she lowers her voice. I bit my cheek to draw blood. I'm fine. Please hurry. He's desperate.
Stay on the phone with me. Don't hang up.
It's about to die. I see the Highway 14 sign and I turn.
Casey, I'm coming from I-40. Are you north or south on Highway 14?
She hesitates. I'm not sure.
Hold on. I'm looking for the furniture store.
It should be about two... The call cuts out.
Casey?
I've lost her, but I've figured out that I'm going the wrong way. I pull over into the left lane and turn around. Then I speed toward her, my eyes scanning the lit buildings for the BP station or the furniture store. There it is, up ahead on the left. I almost hit a car as I speed past it. I see something ahead in the dark. There she is. I recognize her frame. She comes running toward me as I pull into the parking lot. I lean over and unlock the door to let her in. She slides into the passenger seat and throws her arms around my neck. I kiss her face and realize mine is wet. I don't want to let go, but I hold her at arm's length to check her out. Her hands and arms are scraped and both of her wrists are swollen. Her shoulder is still bandaged and there's blood dotting the gauze.
I'm not dead, she says. That's what matters. We have to get out of this part of town.
I turn the car around and drive back into traffic. We're quiet as I try to decide where I should go. I head back to the interstate, intending to get out of this town. When we're far enough away for her to feel safe, she seems to wilt.
He was taking me.
to the middle of nowhere, and he was going to kill me and leave me there, then stage another murder and leave my personal effects at the scene. He may be setting me up right now. My mind races. Yes, he would do that. Find a random person, anyone, to kill and then blame her. Something to prove she's alive. Something to make people fear her even more.
He's digging a deeper and deeper hole,
I say. That's why he's desperate. She looks at me. Where's your regular phone?
I got rid of it.
You need to get rid of the other one, too. I'm afraid they'll track mine. They may have gotten the number of your burner when they had mine. I got it back because he had it in my personal effects. I take out my phone's battery and roll my window down, then throw both mine and hers out.
I'll get new ones tonight.
Dylan, you're going to get arrested if they know you have me.
I can't turn you over to the police.
I told them everything. They listened, took notes, videotaped it. But then, when he came, they just handed me over. They didn't believe a word. She looks at me. What if everyone is like that? What if no one ever believes us?
Someone will.
But I don't want you to be charged because of me.
I can live with jail,
I say. She starts to cry, and I want to pull over and comfort her, but I have to keep driving. I have to get her out of here. 31. Casey. They may not have found my car when they arrested me, she says. I left it down the street from my hotel and walked there. You could take me to it.
No, we're not going anywhere near it.
I'm quiet and look at Dylan. His eyes are intense, and I can see the wheels turning as he puzzles through what to do with me. I hate this. I don't want to cause him to be arrested. Dylan, if we do get caught, if the police stop us somehow, tell them that you caught me, that you were taking me in.
We're not going to get caught.
We can't just drive all night.
Why not?
Because Keegan will find out what you're driving. He'll suspect I got in touch with you. He probably has a bolo out for you already.
He already knows what I'm driving. Trust me.
Maybe you should call Chief Gates, tell him what happened, all of it. Take a chance on the truth.
I'm not taking any chances with you, Casey. If he's involved, it could blow up in our faces.
He takes an exit off the interstate, and I see a Super 8 motel looming ahead.
I'm going to check in.
He says,
get down on the floorboard. Don't let anyone see you.
I unhook my seatbelt and get on the floor. He pulls into the parking lot. I can't see where we are, but he's not near the entry or any overhead lights because there's no light shining down on us. He must have parked in a darker part of the parking lot. Be careful, I whisper.
It's not me they're looking for,
he says.
It's you. Stay down.
He gets out and goes inside. I stay hunkered on the floor, my head down. Despair knots in my throat, stinging my eyes. But then I force my thoughts to do a U-turn. I look where God is working, as Dylan told me to do weeks ago. And when I do, I see him. You helped me get word to someone in authority, I whisper. You helped me think of planting the blood evidence in Keegan's car. You helped me escape from him and kept me hidden. You left enough charge on my phone to call Dylan for help. You had Dylan in Memphis when I needed him. Now the tears flow, but instead of despair, I weep over the miracle of it. God was in on all of this. He's still in on it now. This is all so tangled and so impossible, but God did the impossible tonight. He does it all the time. I'm so overcome by it that I can't formulate an elaborate prayer. I simply whisper, thank you. Dylan comes back to the car after a few minutes, and he doesn't look at me. He starts it up and backs out of the parking lot.
We have a room on the back side of the building. First floor. I'll park near the door.
I wipe my face, not wanting him to see that I've been crying while he was gone. I wipe my eyes and my nose on my sleeve. He pulls the car around, and I feel it stopping again.
There's no one out here,
he says.
I'll unlock the door, then come back to the trunk to get my bag out. You head in while I'm doing that.
He gets out, and I hear him unlocking the motel room door. Then, as he opens the lift gate of the SUV, the light comes on. I open the door and slip out, then hurry inside. In the bathroom, I look at myself in the mirror. My face is dirty. I wash it with soap, rinse it off, and pat it dry. I hear the outside door closing, so I step out. He's standing at the window, looking out the curtains. "Are we okay?" I ask.
"Looks like it. There were only a couple of cars parked on this side. I don't think anybody saw us, and I don't think the cameras could have gotten a good view of you."
He turns from the window and looks at me now, his hands at his sides. His face twists, and he crosses the room and pulls me into his arms. He holds me for a long time, and I cling to him. I don't want to let him go. Finally, he steps back, and I see that his eyes are wet. He takes my hands gently, looks down at my swollen wrists and the scrapes.
"I'll get you some ice."
"No," I say. "Don't leave this room." He pulls me to the small couch against the wall, and I drop down, suddenly aware of how exhausted I am. He sits next to me and pulls me against him. His kiss is salty, desperate, and I feel the urgency in it. I touch the stubble on his face, tears rolling down my own, and slide my fingers through his hair. Suddenly, he pulls back, lets me go, and gets up. I catch my breath and watch him walk across the room, putting distance between us. He turns back to me, his eyes so full of things I can't name that my heart almost breaks.
"The thing is, I'm in love with you,"
he says. My hand goes to my heart, then to my mouth.
"I have been. I don't even know how long,"
he says.
"I want you, but more than tonight. I just can't picture tomorrow without you."
I'm sobbing now, unable to hold it back. I whisper,
"Me too."
He takes a step toward me, but doesn't come much closer.
"God is looking out for us. I don't know if you see it."
"I do,"
I whisper.
"I don't want to dishonor him by following my impulses. I'm in this for the long game."
I know exactly what he means, and I nod my agreement.
"So, I'm going to keep my distance tonight. You sleep in the bed and I'll take the couch."
"Okay," I whisper. Our gazes lock for a long moment, and I want to get up and go to him, touch him again, taste his lips. A soft grin pulls at his lips, and suddenly I'm smiling too. He said he loves me. He wants a future with me. He's willing to wait.
"You're so beautiful,"
he says.
"So are you."
A lifetime of words and emotions passes through our gaze. My heart aches with gratitude.
"Your bandage needs changing,"
he says, stepping toward me and touching my shoulder.
"You may have opened some stitches."
I pull up his pant leg and see the bandages on his calves.
"You don't look so great either."
"Mine's fine. I have bandages in my bag,"
he says. "I'm fine, Dylan."
"You will be."
He digs through his small duffel and pulls out a box of gauze pads and medical tape. He sits on the couch sideways and carefully peels my bandage off. I try not to wince.
"Okay,"
he whispers.
"Good. You didn't break the stitches, you just pulled them."
"I told you I was fine." He cleans the wound with hydrogen peroxide, then carefully fashions a new bandage. When he's done, our eyes lock again. He kisses me, then gets up and moves away from me again. I smile.
"You're killing me."
"We'll have time. This can't go on forever."
It isn't forever I'm worried about, but I don't say that. I get up and look at the bed.
"Do you think it's okay if I take a bath?"
"Sure,"
he says.
"I'll check out the news, see if your disappearance has been reported yet."
I go back into the bathroom and start the bath water. But before I get in, I say another prayer thanking God for tonight. If I wind up in prison tomorrow, or in a grave, at least I will have had these moments.